Bert Cohen here. We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats,
an absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
And one of the most frightening political phrases one might hear these days is, oh, this one's going to be easy. Everyone hates Trump. He's a total disaster. Nothing can stop the blue wave that's coming in November. All we Democrats have to do is stay the course, stick with the safe middle. Whatever we do, now is not the time to rock the boat. That is kind of sentiment really concerns me. Our guest today, longtime political observer and analyst Robert L. Borisage, has reason to disagree as well. I and millions of other rock-solid traditional Democrats share his concern that once again, Democrats could snatch defeat from the jaws of easy victory. As has been noted, 2016 was a wake-up call for Democrats, but half the party is choosing still to ignore it. And there's so much at stake, including our democracy itself. There's debate within the Democratic Party, of course. Some who still believe that the Hillary Clinton corporatist so-called centrist wing are loudly insisting progressive candidates are a serious threat to Democratic chances in the upcoming election, and they're actively pushing activists and their candidates aside. That's the center, so-called center of the Democratic Party. But our guest, Bob Borisage, writes of this energy for populist progressives, quote, to dismiss it as narcissistic or moral vanity is to miss what is a historic and long overdue debate, end of quote. He sees danger from the centers of institutional power within the Democratic Washington establishment. Today, we're going to focus on either a big part of the problem or part of the solution, depending on your point of view. We're talking about the DCCC, Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and what they are up to this year. Robert Borisage, thanks so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
My pleasure.
Bob Borisage is a leading progressive writer and activist. He created a range of progressive organizations, including most recently, the Campaign for America's Future, Progressive Majority, and ProgressiveCongress.org. He guided the Institute for Policy Studies for nearly a decade. He served as issues director for the Jesse Jackson 1988 presidential campaign and consulted on many progressive campaigns, including Senator Paul Wellstone and most recently Representative Jamie Raskin. A contributing editor of The Nation, Borisage's article have been published by Reuters, The Huffington Post, Progressive Breakfast, The Washington Post, and of course The New York Times. Well, again, thanks for being with us. But, you know, Trump is just so bad, so incompetent, so openly racist and sexist. Aren't Democrats likely to win just by running pretty much any halfway decent not Trump candidate for Congress?
Well, there's a decent chance of that. 48 Republicans have announced that they're not running for re-election. So just with open seats and Trump, the most unpopular president ever, and the normal off-year election after a president's elected, Democrats have a damn good chance to, in fact, have a blue wave.
Well, a good chance, but that still, I don't know, it makes me nervous because, you know, Trump is very, very good at, you know, when one shiny thing is done, he'll put another shiny thing out there and distract a lot of people. And it's too big of a risk as far as I'm concerned. We want to talk about the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. When did they come about? Why did they come about? What's a little bit of their history?
Well, DCCC has been in existence really for over a century.
Wow.
In various forms. It's played a major role because it is a major source of resources. It will raise upwards of $150 million for the cycle.
Wow.
It claims to have about 700 staff members assigned to races across the country. It designates both frontline candidates, that is, Democratic incumbents who are endangered, who it directs donations and support to,
right,
and what they call red to blue candidates, the districts that they think are the most winnable from Republicans. And again, they both help identify candidates and they direct donations, both their own and those of independent donors who listen to them, to those candidates in those races.
So they have been around for quite some time. And you say they have a budget of about how much? $190 million or something?
They'll spend over $150 million, probably more this year.
So that's the money that they will either spend on their own local campaign helpers or directly to the campaign? Or how does that work?
They turn into, they do both independent expenditures with uh-huh. people. And they do direct campaign contributions through a PAC to specific candidates. So they do both sides of it. Most of the money is spent in independent expenditures on TV ads, mostly negative, going against the opponents of Democratic candidates. They maintain about 20-25 researchers in Washington that do opposition research. On Republicans across the country.
Well, that's certainly a big help to be able to do that, and that's a fair chunk of change. And certainly the people who they have on the ground, I mean, I know I've spoken with the person who does the New England area, and they do keep pretty busy, and they certainly want Democrats to win. And I will tell you, as you may or may not know, I ran for the Democratic nomination for Congress way back in 1986. But back then with the DCCC, there was a hard and fast rule against picking winners and endorsing in a primary. I had the impression, in general, that they favored the more conventional candidate, the one who raised the most money. There may have been action behind the scenes back then, but what about now? Do they openly choose candidate in Democratic congressional primaries? If so, how and when and why did that change?
Well, they've gotten more active. Rahm Emanuel was the head of the DCCC in 2004, I believe. And he very much wanted the DCCC to get in the business of selecting candidates who they thought could win in various districts. And it was Emanuel's view that Democrats ran too many social liberals and in conservative districts, and that if they ran people who, quote, fit their district, unquote, they'd have a better shot. So he sent out people to go out and recruit former Republicans and business people and, veterans, people with a conservative sensibility that might fit more conservative districts. That was the second screen. The first screen is, can you give or raise a lot of money for your race?
Right.
His basic principle was the first business of a candidate is to raise a lot of money, and if you can't show that you could either give it or raise it, we don't want to get behind you.
Yeah,
those two principles have stayed in play in the DCCC ever since, and they've been active in both recruiting candidates and in kind of in specific races, sometimes interfering and showing their preference to different candidates. This year they've faced a new problem, which is there's massive energy out in the country
Yes.
For particularly on the progressive side of the spectrum, coming out of the Sanders campaign and the Me Too movement and Black Lives Matter, et cetera. So you see enormous numbers of candidates coming into races, many of them first-time people, many of them coming out of movements or activism rather than out of traditional political circles.
Huh.
And the DCCC has, in some cases, taken it upon itself to suggest, well, this person or that person is a better candidate for this district than these others, and to weigh in to try to put their thumb on the scale for some candidates over others. That tends to be a preference for more centrist candidates than the progressive challengers that are entering with great energy into these races.
Well, it's interesting that you use the phrase fit the district. And, you know, there are local people who may have been involved in movements, Me Too, and various protest things that may have a lot of energy, but may not know the electoral history of a district quite as well. It may be kind of starry-eyed, but not really in touch. Then again, who the heck is the DCCC to decide who fits the district, what the district is like? Isn't it about democracy with a small d, leaving it up to the local people to figure that out?
Yeah.
Sounds like you've...
I think that's absolutely true. First of all, there's two different questions here. One is the DCCC's record over the last years has been less than
about that.
Sterling.
Yes.
Democrats have lost control of the Senate, the House, 1,000 state legislative seats. The political establishment of operatives and consultants that operate in Washington are not exactly the people, if they were mechanics, that you would hire to fix your car, given that record. So the DCCC's choices may, in fact, not be the right ones, and certainly their record doesn't give you any confidence that they should make the decision. The second thing is we have a big argument taking place inside the Democratic Party. You saw it in the 2016 primaries. And it's an argument about the direction of the country, about the coalition the party is going to build, about the way it's going to do politics. And you have out of the Sanders campaign and out of Black Lives Matter and other movements, real energy coming to change the direction of the party and the direction of the country.
Yes.
And so it's not like this is politics as usual. This is a big substantive argument about where we go, about the role of money in politics, about whether Democrats are building a coalition that is grounded in the professional suburbs linked to African Americans and Latinos put off by Republican racism, or whether it's building a working class party across lines of race with very different agenda, obviously. And so that's the fight that has to take place inside the party. And what you would like is for the DNC to stay out of it. Let people decide. Let them have the argument. Let people decide who they want to carry the banner in the general election. And people may make some bad choices, but given the DCCC's record, they're likely to make worse choices on the whole.
Well, if you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. It's a group effort, folks. Our guest today is Robert Borisage, leading progressive writer, organized, created the Campaign for America's Future, Progressive Majority, etc. And we're talking about the insider effort, the DCCC, their record, what their influence is on the congressional races this year. And, you know, people focus on the presidential, like it's all about celebrity. But I'll tell you, picking a new Congress is at least as important. And the Republicans know this because they're very scared if there were to be a Democratic majority. And talking about the DCCC, I can a little bit of local experience. In 2006, which was a big wave year for Democrats, we did really well. I'm not sure if it was open or subtle, but the DCCC supported a good guy named Jim Craig to be the Democrat for Congress in this congressional district, New Hampshire District 1. There was great surprise when he lost to an energetic, principled activist with virtually no money who just this year is finally retiring from Congress. I'm talking about Carol Shea Porter, who's been, you know, good traditional Democrat, liberal. They must have a generally positive track record to be able to continue to raise money. I mean, I don't know how much of an aberration the 2006 thing was, but that was like a classic case of them telling us what the, you know, right way to go was. And we said no, and we won rather nicely, and we got a good progressive in there. So how is there, I mean, I know the DNC, Democratic National Committee, is having a heck of a hard time raising money. We know why. I mean, Tom Perez is just not doing a good job. But what about the DCCC? How is their, you know, they raise a lot of money from a lot of different places and help local campaigns. How has their fundraising been going? And they must have some sort of a positive track record.
It's been going gangbusters.
Really?
Partly that's because Democrats across the country are desperate to take back the House.
Yeah.
And so money is flooding into the DCCC and into individual campaigns of Democrats who, in many cases, are out raising their Republican incumbent opponents.
Yeah.
And so you see this flood of both small donations and large donations going into the DCCC.
Hmm.
The other thing is that, in some ways, the secret, not-so-secret weapon of the DCCC is Nancy Pelosi raises a huge amount of that money. She does about 300 fundraisers a year. She has an amazing amount of energy. She has immense credibility among liberal donors. She has a circle of donors who are enormously loyal to her. She is kind of the special sauce that makes the DCCC incredibly successful in its fundraising.
Interesting. I know that as we were talking about Carol Shea Porter, she is a fan of Nancy Pelosi as well. And I'm sure it's because it helps. I mean, it really, she does, Nancy Pelosi does help, you know, a progressive like Carol Shea Porter. So, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, I suppose. But I still wonder, you know, if this year is different, you know, as we talk about politics as usual. I mean, if you have politics as usual, the DCCC is like, you know, well-oiled machine. They raise a lot of money and they help. They know the operations of how a good congressional campaign should be run, and they can really help out. But as you say, this is not a politics as usual kind of year. But we'll find out. I mean, there's still that discussion within the party, and it's sometimes it's loud and sometimes it's acrimonious, unfortunately. And in 1972, I was, of course, a McGovern supporter. And after McGovern's defeat, my dad, also a solid Democrat, became wistful for the days of the smoke-filled back rooms, which kind of surprised me because he was a good liberal. Was it not more often true than not true that those influential people with a personal stake in victory were better at picking winners? I mean, that those old smoke-filled back rooms?
We decided as a country to move away from backroom politics into primaries for the very reason that we believed that small-D democracy ought to work rather than kind of the smoke-filled backroom of moneyed interests making the decision about who's going to be a candidate. And so at the very least, the primaries force the candidates of the moneyed interests to face a test in some cases of more unwashed candidates, if you will, and to see if they can, in fact, rally the support of their own party to be the nominee. I think in this circumstance, where you have this disruption of our politics, you have utter failure on the part of the Democratic establishment politically. You have a politics that, or a political economy that really has not worked for most Americans. You have the utter disruption and dismay caused by the orange menace in the White House. And you have immense energy on the progressive side of the spectrum.
Yes.
that this is a very different political year, and it's particularly important in these times when you that you allow people, Democrats and Democratic voters in districts, to pick their own champion. The thing that the DCCC, I think, generally underestimates is the importance of activist energy, enthusiasm, and passion in politics. They tend to be passion, people, yes. The DCCC tends to look at candidates, as I said, on the basis of can they raise or give a lot of money, and then, quote, do they fit the district? That is, can they appeal to moderates in the district that might add to the Democratic vote to create the majority to win the district? But in off-year elections, particularly when there's not a president at the top of the ticket, turnout is very low.
Yes.
And the candidate that can ignite the base of the Democratic Party and can inspire enthusiasm of activists and can mobilize volunteers to knock on doors across districts has a much better shot at producing victories than the kind of cookie-cutter, well-groomed traditional candidates that people are increasingly skeptical about.
So I'm guessing the ideal DCCC candidate would probably be, well, maybe you can describe him or her. Somebody with some money, probably, or at least raised a lot of money if he or she doesn't have a lot of money. Somebody who...
Well, a good example is excuse me, what happened in Nebraska.
Okay.
Where the one race in Nebraska where Democrats might have a shot around Omaha, the DCCC supported a former Republican, relatively blue dog Democrat now, a conservative Democrat,
mm-hmm.
Who had held the seat previously and then lost it to the incumbent Republican. They picked him as their candidate, and progressives lined up behind Laura Eastman, who was brand new to politics, came out of community organizing, running a nonprofit. Worked incredibly hard, knocked on a lot of doors, mobilized a lot of volunteers, didn't have as much money, nearly as much money as the DCCC candidate had, and beat him in the primary. And that's the kind of classic choice that the DCCC would make, the cautious choice.
Cautious.
And it classically underestimates the energy and passion of activists. Now, what happens there is that race used to be on the red to blue list for the DCCC. That is a race that they thought right. They could win the seat with this candidate. Right. I suspect they will take it off that list now, arguing that she has less of a chance and the seat now is not one of their prime targets. Again, I think that's a mistake. I think that the energy shown in the primary could well, it's a long shot still, but it could well... be sufficient to carry her to a truly remarkable victory in that district. That's the kind of energy and turmoil that's taking place, not just in Nebraska, but around the country, and where the tradition, the politics as usual, sort of makes the safe choice, and the safe choice is often the wrong choice.
Boy, I'm reminded of in 2016, states like Michigan and Wisconsin, where certainly the Democratic insiders inside the Beltway figured, oh, what do they get? I mean, they're Democrat. They always vote Democrat. Well, they didn't. And I think a lot of what seems different this year, among many things, is that he perhaps used to be able to take Democratic votes somewhat for granted, that, you know, if your father, your grandparents voted Democrat, you'll vote Democrat. But people are less party-oriented, I'm finding, anyway, this year. And so it's less, you know, as you talk about, there has to be passion. There has to be something firing people up to get people out to vote. Because they don't, I think a lot of people don't vote because they feel like, well, they believe what they've been told, that their vote doesn't count, that we're powerless. I mean, the Republicans have been saying that for years, and a lot of people nowadays believe it. But, you know, it brings us to the point of the universe that used to be counted on to come out every year you know, granted it's smaller in the off-year elections, would in fact come out and would do as they always do, vote Democrat. I think this year is different. And I wonder, I mean, the DCCC can't be blind to that, you think?
No, I don't think it's blind to it, but it's hard to avoid the kind of traditional calculus.
Uh-huh.
I do think the good news is that Democrats across the country are learning the lesson that this is a time to vote, I mean, to run on basic bread and butter issues. Affordable health care, Medicare for all, tuition-free college, on going after Republicans for giving tax cuts to the rich while trying to cut Social Security and Medicare. And you'll see Democratic candidates of all political stripes, whether they consider themselves to be liberal or conservative Democrats, more and more running on these basic economic populist issues. And that, I think, augurs well for the fall. That's the basic message that really has to go after not simply Trump, but the Republican Congress, which has essentially waged war on working and middle-class Americans and been utterly shameless in serving their donors with tax cuts and deregulation.
It's amazing, the pay-to-play and the, you know, really almost blatant corruption. But you're right. And I wonder, you know, it's been said it's the economy, stupid. Now, in some ways, the economy is looking better. The Dow is up. The S&P is up. The jobless rate is holding at, what, under 4%. And you were talking about, you know, Medicare for all, housing, things like that. I wonder if the economy is something that the Democrats should be talking about. Does that inspire passion? What's your sense of that, Bob?
Well, there's no question Republicans are going to run on the economy and on the tax cut, arguing that their tax cuts have helped create this low, this high employment economy with low unemployment and the beginnings maybe of an inkling of wage increases as labor markets get tight. The reality, however, is that for most American, wages aren't keeping up with costs of necessities like health care, like housing,
for
like
sure.
college, like the cost of daycare if you have a young child. Fully half of the country is basically unable to save as they live paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah.
And Republicans are blocking raising the minimum wage, waging war on labor unions that can, in fact, give workers a better stake at the workplace, doing tax cuts which benefit the very rich,
right.
and thus taking money that might otherwise be spent on rebuilding the country and putting people, even more people, back to work. So I think they're very vulnerable on the economy, even though this is the best economy we've seen in decades.
And I wonder if the DCCC has talking points, sort of a national talking points list, or if they really do, tailor them to the local area. I mean, I wonder if they're interested in talking about the economy. My guess is
they do both national message for candidates, although not as much as you would think. And then they do very tailored local, both opposition research and some local talking points.
Well, that opposition research is very important, very important, because you know they're doing it on our side, that's for sure. And if you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're talking with Robert Borisage about the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, if it's best this year to go with centrist candidates or more passionate candidates of the left. There are those who, winning may not be everything, but maybe it really is. I think winning is pretty much everything. There's danger in purity, I have found. I often say purity is poison. To win, Democrats have to be pragmatic. I don't see some vague notion of centrism as the same thing as what I would call pragmatism. I mean, I think, you know, we have to find out what works, what wins, and that's pragmatic. Centrism is not always the same thing as pragmatism. Some party insiders like Jonathan Alter argue that left-leaning activists are indulging, his words, in primary fights over what he calls minor policy differences. Alter worries that, as you write, more progressive candidates might actually beat well-funded moderates with better chances of winning in November. And in this most important election, Democrats should put party and country over personal preference, he argues, and resist voting for the candidate whose views they support. Instead, favor the one more likely to win the general election. I wonder if you could comment on that. I suspect you can.
I think Alter's perspective is clueless in a whole range of different ways. It's clueless about the argument that's going on in the country and in the party about the direction of the country, which is certainly not about minor differences. It's clueless about what generates energy and activism and voter turnout in an off-year election. And it's clueless about what independent voters or the center is and what appeals to them. He assumes that in red districts, you've got to get cautious about being for abortion, or you've got to be do a little bit of dog whistle politics on race, or you've got to brandish your gun to prove that you're good on guns, and that, or you've got to be for proclaim that you're for a balanced budget and for low taxes to appeal to the center.
Sure.
I think that's that mistakes where people are. Independent voters in poll after poll after poll, those that don't line up with either party, are in fact incredibly populist about economic issues. They care like everybody cares about what's happening to their wages, whether they can afford to educate their kids, whether they can get decent housing, whether they can afford health care. This is a society that where the largest cost of largest source of middle class bankruptcy is a serious illness, which is a remarkable disservice to the country. And you have a Republican Party that's trying to dismantle
what
little coverage we have with Obamacare and making it much more expensive. And they ought to pay a price for that. And it is the people who tend to be progressive populists who can talk to those issues that have a better shot at appealing to what is now called the independent voter.
Mm.
So I think Alter gets the politics wrong, the country wrong, and the debate we need to have wrong.
And that scares me quite a bit, I have to say. And there are people who, as we all know, one thing I've learned from history is that we never learn from history. We didn't learn the lesson of Vietnam. We keep doing it over and over. And a lot of people refuse to learn what happened in 2016. The independents, I mean, I don't know of any scientific study. I'm sure there are quite a few. But my own non-scientific research was that independents were deciding between Bernie and Trump. They didn't like Hillary. I don't know if it was entirely the Republican talking points or just that Hillary didn't connect. And, you know, I didn't see any message from that campaign. And I don't know, I would think that people are looking for a message, something to fire them up. And it's not just the, bland centrist Democrat that's going to do that. So,
I think mostly the political establishment in both parties doesn't understand the extent to which Americans want to shake things up. Trump was elected not because he was a jerk, but because he presented him as somebody who was a jerk who would come to Washington and shake things up. And,
exactly.
And he's got a lot of license from voters because they think he's coming in to change the way things are done, and that's they're looking for that to happen. I don't think they're going to be happy with what he's done and how he's done it.
Right.
That's the mandate he got. And there's no question that Hillary, who was by far the more experienced and the better prepared candidate to be president, was seen correctly, I think, as somebody who ran on a platform we're already great. We need more of the same, and we can do better. And was presented herself really as a continuation of the Obama years rather than as
right.
kind of fundamental change. And that hurt her an enormous amount in the general election. Yeah. People are looking for change. This is an economy that doesn't work, that puts enormous pressure on most Americans. We have a declining life expectancy in an advanced industrialized economy, which is grotesque. People are demanding that things get shaken up, and so the old kind of calculus doesn't work anymore.
Boy, I think you're right, and I had a friend of mine who was long ago passed away. He was a Unitarian minister, and he said he suggested that at election time, people either want more of the same or change. You know, it's one or the other. Clearly, 2016, people demanded change. Trump was change. My guess is by 2020, and we're not talking about that now, people might be kind of freaked out by how much change there's been. But my guess is now that people are still in the we demand change mode, and still shaking things up. What's your sense of that?
I think people will be in we demand change in 2022, and the kind of mood of throwing the bums out is
continuing,
pretty deeply entrenched, and it'll help Democrats this fall, I believe.
I think so.
The one thing Democrats, I'm for these big debate in the party. I'm for primaries, even against incumbent Democrats, to carry that debate. I applaud the energy and the courage of people who haven't been in politics or have decided to run. I think the one thing that everybody ought to be clear about, though, is at the end of the primary season, when we pick somebody, whether it's our candidate or the other candidate,
right.
there's got to be a coming together and a unity around that in order to take back the Congress this fall. It is, I think we're all agreed across the party that it is incredibly important to win the majority of the House. And in order to do that, it will require, after these primaries, that they become, they feed energy, not drain it.
Yeah.
And the way that has to happen is for people to come together and to endorse the winner and put their energies into getting that person elected.
And
I think Trump and the Republican Congress are so offensive that they're likely to make that easier than normal. But it's important that we not forget about that.
Oh, for sure. And I was concerned. I don't think it was a large percentage, but I was a Bernie delegate, strong Bernie supporter. And there were some on that side who just wouldn't vote for Hillary. And that frustrated the heck out of me. I mean, was she perfect? No. But we can never make the perfect the enemy of the good. Was it a lesser of two evils? Yeah, much lesser. Much lesser. And I wonder about that new segment that we're talking about here, Bob. The passionate, the people who haven't been involved in politics before. I worry, quite frankly, about them doing the same thing. And, if their candidate doesn't make it for the general election, the DCCC must be aware of that. And hopefully, Bernie Sanders knew how important it was to get behind the nominee. But I am a little bit concerned about that, that people, if they don't get exactly what they want, may not vote. But I hope we can come together. I think that, just as Nixon was the best organizer against the war in Vietnam, hopefully Trump will be the best organizer of all Democrats. And the Republicans that just are, kowtowing to him, that should do it.
I'm more worried that the establishment of the party won't unify rather than that the insurgents won't unify.
Interesting.
That the DCCC, when it sees a Laura Eastman win an election, a primary against their candidate in Nebraska, will decide, well, that's not a race we can win anymore, and pull the plug on directing donors to support her and et cetera.
Interesting. So if they don't get what they want.
People are worried about insurgents getting embittered, but we shouldn't forget that it's the party establishment that often leaves these races when their candidate gets beat equally embittered.
And not only are they embittered, but they take their money with them. They take their ball and go home. That's a real concern because they have a lot of money. That's a very good point that, you know, if their chosen one doesn't make it, that they'll just walk away from and say that's not a winnable district. That's really very much of concern. Do you think the DCCC and others are, they've got to see that this year is a bit different, that they can't just do that, can't just walk away. But I don't know. I mean, they do pick winners, that's for sure. What about the Russia-Trump thing that, you know, people think that maybe that'll do it. It's so obvious that Russia did collude with Trump. Trump has no idea what the word collusion means, apparently. I think
the Russia stuff is a rabbit hole the Democrats have gone down that there's no rabbit at the end of it. People are struggling in this economy, and they are Democrats have a mandate to make the case for them that we can actually get things done that will help.
Excellent. Yes.
And certainly Republicans have done things that will make things worse. And if we don't make that case, if we don't stick on those questions that are about people's daily lives, we'd be making a very big mistake. Arguing about the last election and whether the Russians run it or James Comey did it or whatever doesn't make much sense to me.
No, it really doesn't. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. We're talking on Keeping Democracy Alive with Robert Borsage about the DCCC and the problem with imposing centrists from Washington out on the rest of the country. And there are many on the left who demand, and the term the left, you know, I see these headlines from time to time saying, oh, the Democrats are moving to the hard left. It's not hard left. I mean, Dwight Eisenhower domestically was to the left of most Democrats these days, I think. But anyway, there are people on the progressive side who demand that all congressional candidates be solidly pro-choice and solidly favor stricter gun laws. I'm not sure that's such a great idea. That purity shouldn't. I mean, what's your sense of that? There are lots of people I know who, if the candidate is not solidly pro-choice, they'll just walk away and not help him or her. Your thoughts?
Well, I think people have every right to do that. You know, a woman's control of her body strikes me as a kind of fundamental issue, and Democrats are overwhelmingly a pro-choice party, and ought to be proud of that. I'm shocked that it's not a bipartisan consensus, that Republicans have allowed themselves to be hijacked by the extreme anti-abortion folks. So I don't have a problem with people saying I'm prepared to support somebody who's not for choice. The energy coming out of the kids around guns, I think, is a good thing.
Yeah.
It's the job of political leaders to figure out both what they believe and how they're going to argue it so that it can translate to the people in their district. So Connor Lamb, for example, Everybody talks about how Connor Lamb did an ad where he had his gun and showed that he was pro-gun, but Connor Lamb, he was in a Republican-leaning district in a special election, which he won.
Yes.
He also was for universal background checks and for, I think, as I remember, banning assault rifles. Raising the age to which you can buy a rifle.
Right.
So he figured out both what he believed and how he would argue it to his constituents to be able to win that race. Good politicians do that. Political leaders must do that. But I don't have a problem with supporters saying, I'm not going to support somebody who's against a woman's right to control her own body.
Yeah, it is. It is pretty basic. It's true. And I, you know, part of the issue that's been raised sometimes is that, you know, frankly, Catholic voters used to be a solid part of our base, the Democratic base, working class. And now the choice issue is pushing a lot of them away. And that's a lot of numbers there. But I mean, I suppose that's one issue that I mean, I'm certainly pro-choice.
Yeah, but I don't even believe that that's true. Look, in Ireland, the Catholic Church just went nuts trying to get Catholics in Ireland to keep the constitutional provision against abortion, and they voted overwhelmingly to get rid of it. And allow,
that's a good point.
Allow abortions in Ireland. I think that, yeah, the Church is against it, but you know, Ted Kennedy was the most popular Catholic politician, and he was personally against abortion and politically for pro-choice. That seems to be a standard that many political leaders have been able to hold who are Catholic in their own personal religion. We've tended to lose Catholic voters because we've allowed the labor unions to get destroyed.
Right.
We've abandoned our role as a working class party.
Yes. That's more than anything.
We had spoken less and less to the economic concerns that many of those people, when they don't hear that, then the social issues become more important.
Well, and I think, quite frankly, the last 2016, there was the whole, in the 1990s, the Democratic Leadership Council, which changed the direction of the party, went for easy money. Of course, you need money to win, so they go for the easy money, big chunks of money from very wealthy people. And I think a lot of the working class, which was our base, felt like the Democratic Party had turned their backs on them. And I think Bernie was connecting with them. But frankly, I don't think our nominee did all that much. Let's shift to a personal characteristic, authenticity. Many years ago, the great political philosopher Groucho Marx observed, sincerity, if you can fake that, you got it made. As a veteran candidate, an active party person myself, I have to agree with you, Bob, that voters are looking for authentic leaders. People, at least in highly politicized New Hampshire, have a keen sense of who's for real and who's not. Bernie started completely unknown. He won the primary here with a 22-point margin, which was unbelievable. His authenticity, I think, is what did it. It was unquestioned. It came from his core. His challenger, who became the nominee, certainly failed to project authenticity. Aside from positions on the issues of the day, how much of a factor in who wins and who loses do you think authenticity is?
Well, I think people make judgments about, voters make judgments about candidates and whether they, particularly now, whether they think they're simply being political and telling them what they want to hear, or whether they actually believe what they're saying. And cynicism about politicians is at record heights.
Yeah.
So breaking through that is one of the fundamental tasks of, I think, of any successful candidacy. And there's different ways to do it. One of the things Bernie did, of course, was by not taking big donations and not getting any corporate PAC money,
right,
having an average donation of $27, famously a donation. He made it clear that what he was saying was stuff he believed. Nobody was buying or selling him. Ironically, Trump, the billionaire, did that in some ways by claiming he couldn't be bought and sold because he was paying for his own campaign, which turned out to be a lie, but it was at least
I'm shocked.
a credible lie early on.
Yeah.
Elizabeth Warren does it by telling the story of her own upbringing on what she calls the ragged edge of the middle class and integrating that with the political positions that she supports. And she does that more effectively than most Democrats, and it's a very powerful kind of indicator that this is somebody who is arguing a case that she totally believes in it because she's lived it.
That connects.
I think that's incumbent on successful candidates. Successful leaders are able to find a way to speak to people in a way that gets them to see them as an exception to the politics as usual that they're very cynical about.
Yes, people are certainly cynical. And we've heard the term Demexit, you know, after the British Brexit, people exiting the Democratic Party. It pertains to people from the traditional liberal wing of the party and a great many young people who were energized by Bernie Sanders. As you say, some of these activists were embittered, frustrated, and angry with the DNC machinations and just leaving the party because of that. That worries me a lot. It's extremely dangerous to our 2018 prospects. We need those people. I wonder if you could speak to that concern, please. What can be done to win back the people who might be headed for the Dem exit?
Well, you know, two things. I think I'm more amazed in the other way. I'm surprised that so much of the energy that came out of the Sanders campaign and the Me Too movement and Black Lives Matter has come into electoral politics as opposed to being turned off by it.
Oh, interesting.
And you see that in the legions of candidates running in primaries. You see that in the energy of volunteers. You see that in the small donations flooding into campaigns. Democrats ought to be enormously pleased at the notion that that energy is fighting inside the party rather than outside the party and at it. But at the same time, I think the party has to open up. It has to reform its own rules. It has to make itself open to a new generation and to new members, etc. You know, there was a Unity Reform Commission endorsed by Sanders and Clinton mm-hmm. at the convention to reform the rules of the Democratic Party.
Yes.
And part of it was to limit or get rid of the superdelegate votes that are people who are not picked by primary voters and had a huge number of votes in the Democratic convention that were that immediately went over 90% to Clinton.
Yeah.
Some of it was to change the party rules to allow independents to vote, to allow people to register for the party, kind of as the primary approached or on the same day as the primary. In New York, if you're an independent and you wanted to change your registration to be a Democrat to vote in the Democratic primary, you had to do it for next fall's election. You had to do it last October. And that's just a way of the party regulars locking people out, particularly young people who get excited late from the party. And so that commission's been meeting. They've put their rules forth. It's gone through all the interminable various committees of the Democratic National Committee. And they're about to make a decision on them. And the rumor is that they're about to decide, we don't need to change the party any. Forget about it.
Right.
Well, that's the kind of thing that, in fact, will turn people off big time.
Yes.
Unless the party makes efforts to open itself up and to allow the new energy to come in. If it in state parties across the country, people are getting locked out, then you'll see a lot of people being turned off.
And I don't.
One of the interesting things in Pennsylvania, in the Pennsylvania primary, which was a couple weeks ago, was not only did insurgent candidates win up and down the ticket for races, but Keystone Action and other grassroots organizations in the state had about 195 candidates get elected to county and state and local Democratic Party committees.
Wow.
And that's new energy coming into those committees and really beginning to take over the party. And I think that's incredibly important for the party. It's incredibly important for the country, and it's a real promising sign.
Yeah, and it really builds up the bench because we've needed to build up the bench, and that's very exciting. And I know the DCCC has gotten involved in some campaigns. I was particularly following Laura Moser in Texas, and they got involved in that, and I guess it was a tad rough. What can you tell us? Tell us about that.
That was a particularly unfortunate, wrong-headed intervention by the DCCC. they were supporting a corporate lawyer, also a female candidate in the district, in the primary, whose law firm had recently won a case against justice for janitors, helping to shut down a drive in Texas by the SEIU affiliated operation.
My goodness.
So they were supporting her. Laura Moser was an activist who moved into the district and was gaining some momentum. So they actually took their opposition researchers, assigned her to Moser, and did an incredibly disingenuous hit job on her. Basically a cheap shot attack about a quote she had made about not wanting to go back to Brownsville, Texas, where she had grown up. And
that's amazing.
To try to get her, discredit her in the primary. The result was progressives across the country, you know, got irritated, money flooded into the Moser campaign.
Sure.
And she became one of the two people along the DCCC candidate in the runoff. And she certainly probably wouldn't have made that if they hadn't done that that ridiculous intervention. At the end of the day, she lost the runoff last week, and the DCCC's candidate has won. But one hopes they learned a little bit of a lesson doing a kind of Republican-style hit job on a Democratic candidate is not their function.
Wow, it's not. And we don't have much time left here. And the Republican Party, let's look to them and what happened in recent years. There was the Tea Party movement. It was changed dramatically by them. This was grassroots stuff. And you say that the big reform ideas driving the left and the Democratic Party have far wider popular appeal than the Tea Party agenda on the right. That sounds like has great potential. Say more about that, please.
Well, you know, the Tea Party challenged the establishment of the Democratic Party. One of its members even took out Eric Cantor, who is the House number two in the House under Boehner on the Republican side. There's no question they ran insurgent candidates. They were backed by big right-wing money, which helped.
Yeah,
but they drove the party to the right generally, and they kind of changed the course of the party. And the energy on the left now isn't backed by the big money that the Tea Party had, but it has the same kind of energy and insurgent attitude. Only the difference is that it's arguing a case on economic reform that is incredibly popular, where the Tea Party case was popular in Republican areas, but less popular in the general public.
Right. So we can win. We can be pragmatic. We can win. Well, always interesting to talk with you, Bob Borisash. What's the best way people can continue to follow your writings?
Go to ourfuture.org and you'll see my stuff posted there regularly. I also write regularly for The Nation magazine.
Excellent.
And if you go to thenation.com, you can track me there.
Thank you so much for being with us, and let's hope for good things ahead. Hope to talk to you again. Thank you.
Be of cheer. Pleasure to be with you.
Likewise. Well, the winds of change are coming. We can make it happen. It comes from the bottom up, that's for sure. Do your part. Do your part.
Underfoot are the visions.